Committee on Ways and Means for March 10th, 2005. We left yesterday with Mr. Nesbitt in the middle of his testimony, and I guess that's where we will resume.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm a member of the State Board of Higher Education and co-chair of the board's Access and Affordability Work Group. And where we left off yesterday was at slide 41 of yesterday's packet. It's slide 7 of the abridged packet you were handed this morning. And the point I made in my opening remarks yesterday was that there are really three ways in which we try to address the affordability gap or mitigate the unaffordability of the cost of a post-secondary education. And obviously one is the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We covered that, and I'm sure you'll have more questions about the details of the proposal in the governor's budget on that point. The other was all forms of scholarships and grants, which fall under the heading of fee remissions, and of course the third was tuition itself. But on the subject of fee remissions, which are also known as fee waivers or tuition discounts, I want to make the point that these are an important component of financial aid that enables campuses to supplement the available state, federal, and other aid, and also expand access and increase affordability and create a more inclusive and diverse campus. Some 70% of the programmatic fee remissions of the recipients of those are low or moderate income students who receive some type of need-based financial aid as well. And because an Oregon revised statute prohibits use of general fund for student aid, fee remissions provide a way to help our neediest students meet their tuition costs and keep the student loan borrowing at a reasonable amount. Overall, fee remissions are a unique financial aid tool for campuses in that they impact several areas important to students and our state and respond to the board's priority of affordability when used as a supplemental tuition grant, access when used as a tool for diversity, high achievement, also a factor, geographic diversity. You also see an impact on research when grants are provided for particular projects, and these grants extend to our postgraduate students as well. So what we're asking is that you consider a change in the restriction that now applies to fee remissions. In 2003, the legislature issued a budget note limiting programmatic fee remissions to no more than 8% of gross tuition revenue. Prior to this, the fee remissions averaged about 8.7% of tuition revenues. The governor's recommended budget supports a phase-out of the current legislative limit on fee remissions, with an increase in the limit on undergraduate programmatic fee remissions for 2005-07 to 10% from the current 8% of gross tuition revenue, and then the elimination of those limits in 2007-09. Graduate student fee remissions are used primarily to support students who are teaching assistants and teaching fellows. And the graduate fee remissions were limited to $47 million for OUS in 2003-05 by that same budget note. And the governor's budget recommends removing this limit in full in 2005-07. Maintaining the current limit, we believe, would cause a reduction in the number of graduate assistants or in the amount of the remission or compensation that these students would receive. And finally, I think this slide tells a lot of stories and kind of sums up a lot of many of the aspects of the problem we've been describing, the affordability gap in Oregon. If you look at what it cost to attend the University of Oregon full-time back in 1973, in the early 70s, and what you could earn as a student if you were working, let's say working full-time during the summer and working part-time during the school year, or as this chart quantifies it, working at a minimum wage job year-round, you could work your way through school in the early 70s. You could take that summer job, you could work 10 hours a week, and even if it were just a minimum wage job, you could cover your tuition and fees and room and board. Now, if you make the same calculation, looking again at the University of Oregon tuition and fees. That same student would have to work 46 hours a week, year-round, 52 weeks of the year, in order to do that. In very real terms, it's no longer possible to work your way through college. And as a result, you see many more part-time students who are working full-time and going to school part-time, or you see students taking on greater and greater debt in order to get through school. And this situation, I think, highlights more than anything what our students face and why we've been seeing a lost generation of students develop in the past decade. Those who were qualified, were predicted to go on to school, and didn't do so. And if anything, I think, and I've watched some of the focus groups, and I'm sure you hear the same from your constituents, what really gets people's attention on this debate about what the state should be doing to make higher education more affordable. Some of your constituents and many of the public might be wary about an entitlement program. But when they understand the effort that goes into this in terms of a student being prepared and qualified to go on to college, wanting to do so, and being able to, and being willing to work his or her way through college. Now we're talking about individual effort. It's an important part of the equation. But when you can no longer, as a student who's prepared, if you don't have the resources in your family, work your way through college, I think most everyone in Oregon would say there's something wrong with that situation. And the way we can most effectively address this problem, we believe, is through the proposals you've received for increases in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, for moderation of tuition increases, and for more flexibility for the campuses through fee remissions to do further forms of assistance to our neediest and best qualified students. That would have been the completion of my report, except I want to answer one of the questions from yesterday morning, and then I'm happy to take other questions if the committee has them. Chancellor Pernsteiner has provided, it's a letter signed by Dave McDonald, in written form, answers to two of the questions you asked yesterday. If I may address the second, we were asked to provide a comparison of the financial aid effort made by Oregon and Washington. And you see a table attached to that letter, if you all have it, and a chart. And I think the chart is most telling. By the way, I must correct one number on your table. In the box called Need Grant Fall 2003, fourth line from the bottom of that box, funding 2003-04, you see Oregon at $21.7 million. Washington's number should be $124,900,000, not $114,200, but $124,900. And that number is correctly displayed on the chart attached. So when it comes to looking at just need-based financial aid, Oregon, which is a little above half the size of Washington State, provides $21.7 million. Washington State, $124.9 million. And there was a time, as you can see on this time graph, where we pretty much matched effort. The amount of money that Oregon was allocating to financial aid was just about the same as that in Washington State back in 1985-86. Since then, our tuition has increased more rapidly. Our effort in terms of need-based financial aid has barely kept up with inflation, much less the cost of tuition. And now you see that big gap between what Washington State does for its post-secondary students and what we do in Oregon for our post-secondary students based on financial need.
Questions from Mr. Nunes?
Yes. Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure that we need to get into some of this detail at this point, but I would like to know what percentage of Oregon high school students are admitted to the Oregon University system that apply. State school, I'm assuming it's a high number. Also, as we were talking, leaving the meeting yesterday, I remember way back when I was a freshman at a state school in freshman orientation, we used to look to the left and look to the right. The counselor did and says, one of you won't be here next semester. So, I mean, a state school had to accept more students, but they also lost a lot early. So if you could comment on that. Also, I would like to, Mr. Chair, if we can maybe do this in phase two. I don't understand the program about sharing costs with the other states, the western states, and how that balances out. And would you prefer we do that in the second phase?
We will plan to do that in phase two.
Thank you.
Please respond.
Yes, if I may respond, Senator and Representative Wisnant. One number I have in my head, and I think you'll see it in the chart in a later presentation, is that when you look at the number of ninth graders in Oregon and how many then graduate from high school and how many go on to community college or a four-year college and complete either that two-year or four-year education and get that AA or BA degree, BS degree, we start with 100 ninth graders, and we end up with 15 of that 100 completing either that two-year college course within 3 years or that four-year college course within 6 years. 15 of the 100. Nationally, the number is 18 of 100. So it's a combination of preparedness and financial ability. We'll work to get you the data you're asking for in terms of the admission rate, the persistence rates, the completion rates, all those factor in. But we see declines as we kind of go through the checkpoints in student progression at each level. And a lot of what you're hearing in the presentations these days is how we can get students better prepared, how we can promote that continuum. We're talking here about that key point between high school graduation and the decision to go on to pursue a post-secondary education, the cost barriers, and what it takes to overcome those. But I do think your questions are well taken as well as to how we can promote persistence and make sure if the Oregon Opportunity Grant is extended so that it applies year-round and you don't miss the deadline and therefore fail to get it, I think we're going to be reaching a lot more students who are kind of late to make up their mind. And that's important if we want to get them in the system. But I think the other part of your question goes to then how do we keep them in, how do we make that experience successful, and other parts of what we're trying to do with our system, I think, can address that challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One question that I had, Mr. Nesbitt, is that I think it's laudable the focus that the governor has on students that are most in need. But one area that I'm somewhat worried about is that area is kind of in between, particularly towards the lower half of that in between. You know, as we find greater opportunities for those that are most in need, and obviously there are some students who have family resources that don't have those needs, but there is a volume of students kind of in the middle that it's becoming more difficult for working families to send their sons and daughters to college. And I'm just wondering what the focus of OUS is on that issue, because they seem to be very focused on students that, you know, have limited financial capabilities. But I'm just thinking of a family out there in Oregon that might have, sounds like a lot of money, but might have $50,000 or $60,000 in family income. They've got two people working, finding it very difficult to send two kids through college.
Senator, thank you for that question. I share your concern, since most of the working families I represent on my day job fit in that category. And it's a concern that I share and that our work group shared. And we want to make sure that we're addressing in the short term and the long term not just those insurmountable financial barriers that a very low-income person might face. No way I can afford it. No way I can work my way through college. But also those high, maybe not insurmountable, but high and telling financial barriers that a middle-income family might face when they're trying to make the calculation. And certainly if they have more than one child about to be in college at the same time, these are daunting, maybe not insurmountable, but daunting and discouraging factors as well, and we want to address those. And I think the primary way we talked about addressing those is to go to a model for our Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is more like the Pell Grant, which is based on an expected family contribution. Right now, our Opportunity Grant has a ceiling, and if a family's income goes $1 above that ceiling, they are no longer eligible for the Opportunity Grant. The Pell Grant has a sloped, so that's the cliff. The Pell Grant has a sloped approach, whereas if you earn a little bit more money, the size of the grant is reduced. And there's a slope that is based on what's called the EFC, the Expected Family Contribution. So you're filling in that a little bit. You're providing a little bit more help for that middle-income family. And that's where we hope to get to over time. And if I could take another moment and call your attention to the handout that you saw from us yesterday, which is the structure of the Opportunity Grant as proposed at the $91.6 million level. Really, what we're dealing with are ways to reach more students with the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and ways to provide more assistance to those we reach. And pretty much all the pieces on the page fit in one or the other of those categories. We're reaching more students by extending the grant year-round, so we no longer have a calendar cutoff. We're reaching more students by extending the grant to part-timers, a big and long overdue improvement. We're providing more assistance by raising the size of the grant and putting more money out there to students who choose to go to our lower-cost public institutions. So we're starting to equalize the differences there. And finally, we're also providing more assistance with incentives by providing a challenge grant to entering freshmen who completed the Certificate of Initial Mastery in high school. So there's a little other way of doing providing more, and that's doing it in a targeted way that provides incentives to students to become better prepared. We would like to continue the effort to cover more students by raising the family income level and modeling it on the Pell Grant. And we'd like to continue to provide, to increase the amount of assistance to each eligible student by increasing the size of the award. So what I'm pleased to say is that the recommendations you see on this sheet, which is based on the $91.6 million, all fit with the longer-term goals and restructuring that we hope to achieve over time, where we actually could have a Oregon Opportunity Grant that looks very much like the Pell Grant, that covers more students in the middle-income range, and provides more assistance on a cost-effective basis.
Another telling thing in the handout that you have, and I'll go for the higher figure for Washington, the 4,081. When it says that meets 94% of tuition and fees for an undergraduate, that tells me that their undergraduate tuition is lower than ours.
That's correct, Senator. And our goal over time is to get to 100%, but a maximum of 100% tuition and fees at community colleges and OUS institutions.
How do you respond? This is a response I'm going to get in other quarters, or a query that I'm going to get in other quarters, that the higher your remissions go in terms of percentage of students, the more costs are transferred to those students that are paying tuition. How do you respond to that?
The Chair Devlin, I think I'll take that one. And I want to divide fee remissions into two parts. The first is to deal with...
You need to identify...
Oh, I'm sorry. George Kernsteiner, Acting Chancellor, Oregon University System. Fee remissions into two parts. The first deals with the graduate fee remissions, which are essentially part of the pay for the teaching assistants. I mean, and so I don't see them in the same category as undergraduate fee remissions. The undergraduate fee remission policies have been adopted over the last 15 years in order to achieve some goals that the state has set. Some of those goals have been affordability goals, some of them have been diversity goals, and some of them in terms of dealing with various issues that have come up. The first large fee remission was done in the 1980s for international students. It was part of diversifying the campus by bringing in international students. And those students then and now have a service component to what, there aren't that many of them, they have a service component that is required for them to work not just at the universities, but in the community and in the schools in order to help bring sort of information about other countries and cultures to the state. The second one that came in really was a program in 1990 that dealt with a major increase in tuition which we had, and at that time we had a fee remission program that was directly targeted to the lowest income of our students, and that's still one of the largest portions of what we do. It's a fee remission that deals with those students who otherwise could not afford to attend. The third category deals with diversity. We were attempting in the fee remissions to be able to provide a more diverse campus culture at each of our campuses that more reflected the Oregon that we have and that we expect to have over the next several years. Those are the main programs. The total amount of those allows then the campuses to balance the kinds of students whom they have, to give opportunities to students who otherwise wouldn't come. One of the things that we learned when the fee remissions were capped this year is that we lost in terms of keeping the student in school between, say, the freshman year and the sophomore year, a larger proportion of lower-income students than we lost of higher-income students because they no longer had the fee remission. So does it affect the net tuition paid? You could argue that it does. You could also argue that it doesn't. The tuition was set independently of those fee remission amounts except for that 1990 amount that dealt with a direct agreement that we had with the legislature at that time to provide 25% of what that increase was back in the way of helping people afford it. Other than that, I don't know that there's ever been a direct link made between the size of the tuition and the size of the remission programs. But the remission programs are intended to help students get through school and to diversify the campuses which we have to more reflect Oregon.
Senator Witt.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Nesbitt, how does Oregon's undergraduate fee remission policy compare with other states like Washington? Could you quantify in dollars that 8% remission and 10%? And also, does $133 million figure at the bottom of your pyramid there on the state grant and aid to undergraduate students, does that include that fee remission, or is that in addition to the $133 million?
Which chart is that? Oh. The 133 does not include, Senator Whitsitt, fee remissions. That is the Oregon Opportunity Grant amount that is spread across all of the students. With respect to other states, we have a chart. I don't have it with me, but we can provide it to you on Monday. But I've seen a chart that compares us with other states. Our fee remissions, on average, are lower than those that predominate in most of the states that we looked at. So we can provide you that on Monday, and also what the dollar amounts would be at the 8% level and at the 10% level based on the tuition which we anticipate in the governor's recommended budget. That's part of the presentation that we would be making on either day 4 or day 5, so I know we have those data.
One follow-up. It would seem intuitive that if you're reducing the tuition cost for 8 to 10% of your students, that would increase the other cost of the university.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, that would seem intuitively obvious. However, there are students who would not attend otherwise. Most of the remissions are not full fee remissions. They are partial fee remissions. And the question then is, would the student have attended and paid his or her other tuition, which is most of what the cost is, if it hadn't been for the fee remission? And this is particularly true, as the University of Oregon folks have pointed out, with regard to the very limited number of fee remissions they give to non-residents, essentially attracting then a $15,000 payment for perhaps a $1,000 remission. And their point on that, and it was demonstrated to some legislators during the interim, was that, in fact, in that limited case, they wind up with more income than they would have had otherwise. If you're dealing with Oregon residents, the question then is really one of helping them to be able to afford to go to college, but they are still paying some of, and in most cases, most of the tuition. The remission is not the whole amount.
And follow up, and this is, as a business person, a portion of your business that loses money. And I'm not, you know, I mean, let's call it what it is. I mean, I'm not saying that a fee remission is a bad thing at all, but it does, the money that they are not paying for tuition has to come from somewhere else. And if you have 100 students that you bring in that are paying less than it costs to educate them, then there's going to that extra money is going to have to come from somewhere else. It would seem from my point of view.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, I understand the point of view. I think part of our mission, though, is to serve particularly Oregon students and to try to serve as many of those students as we can. This is one of the mechanisms that we have used to help keep some of the neediest students in school. We're in a situation system-wide where, in fact, as everyone knows, the in-state tuition does not pay the full cost. That we do receive some state appropriation to assist with a whole variety of Oregon students. So the business analogy breaks down somewhat in a situation like this, except when you're talking about the non-resident students who pay more than the cost of instruction. So that's...
If you want to close, Ms.
Brené. Senator, I'll just repeat and summarize, actually, by saying that the challenge of keeping our post-secondary educational institutions affordable and accessible really gets to matching the effort that other states are already making and we haven't kept up with in terms of need-based financial aid. And that's the Oregon Opportunity Grant proposal, which we're urging your support for. Also, as best we can, moderating our tuition increases and then providing the flexibility as well at the campus level to use fee remission scholarships of the kind Megan Ward told you about yesterday, to enable students who otherwise might not be able to attend. All of these are, this is kind of the three-pronged approach, and there are offsetting relationships among each factor. But we've put a lot of work into giving you our best proposals covering all three areas, and we think as a package, individually and as a package, all of these proposals will greatly advance our goals of making our system a little more affordable for our neediest students and getting us to the point where, for middle-income families as well, the cost of a post-secondary education at community colleges and OUS institutions is a little less daunting, a little more affordable, and that as a result, we do a better job of educating more students in the coming biennium.
Thank you. Chancellor, should we move on to our next...
Yes, I would also call your attention, Chair Devlin, to the letter that we provided this morning. It answers the other question about the transfer of credits and the transfer of grade point averages. So, Ed Ray, who is the president of Oregon State University, is here today to introduce a discussion of the statewide public services. Statewide public services include the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Oregon State University Extension Service, and the Forest Research Laboratory. Those portions of Oregon State University are at the essence of its land-grant mission. They are statewide efforts that have for many years been part of OSU, and I think it's important that President Ray have an opportunity this morning to introduce that subject.
Good morning. I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University. I'm only going to take a few minutes to provide some overview of the programs that the statewides provide. We have, I think, some more compelling and well-informed speakers that it would be helpful for you to hear from. I guess if there's one thing that I'd hope you'd remember in my comments, it would be that as the land-grant university in Oregon, those of us at Oregon State University take our mission very seriously, and that mission is that we were created to serve the needs of the people of Oregon with respect to education, with respect to economic development, and with respect to community building. And frankly, we view it as both an honor and a privilege to have responsibility for managing the statewide programs. As the Chancellor indicated, the statewides include the Extension Service, the Experiment Stations, and the Forest Research Laboratory. Those programs reach into all 36 counties. We have 14 experiment stations in 11 different locations. We touch lives in virtually every part of the state. One of the aspects of the statewides that it's important to keep in mind as we talk about this in the context of the OUS budget is that these are line item funded programs, and so unlike other parts of the OUS budget, there really are no other sources of funding that can help us compensate for budget reductions such as tuition or other things that are available to the universities in a more general sense. So for the world of statewides, a cut is a cut. To give you a sense of the kind of magnitudes we're talking about, as it currently stands through the governor's budget, between 2001 and 2005, the Extension Service, Experiment Stations, and Forestry Research Laboratory have taken 13% cuts in budgets, and that's resulted in an approximately 25% reduction in staffing. And the reduction, obviously, is a combination both of the cuts and cost increases over time in things like the retirement fund and funds and health benefits and so forth. So there's been a 25% cut in staffing. I can tell you that in the year and a half that I've been in Oregon, I've had the opportunity to travel through most parts of the state. I've told people that if you look at the weather map on the Oregonian, they list 17 cities, and my wife Beth and I have stayed in 16 of the 17 and a lot of places in between. So we've had a real opportunity to get out there and meet people and get a sense of what their lives are about. I also told people when I first came here that I thought Oregonians were a lot like Midwesterners. And there's an expression, Midwest nice. And it was when I went out into the various counties and started meeting people and hearing about their issues that I discovered that unlike the Midwest, people out here have a kind of edge. You don't have to guess if they have a problem with what you're doing or how they feel you're treating them. And so they've been pretty forthright and direct with me. And I've had people talk to me with genuine concern about the cuts in services that they've experienced. People have talked to me about the need for hydrologists in places like Klamath Falls in Ontario. They've talked about the loss and the need for the restoration of entomology services and again, in places like Ontario and Burns. While I've heard people talk about their concerns with the university's services and with presumably my performance in providing or not providing those services, I think it's worth pointing out that what people seem frustrated about is certainly not the quality of the services that they've been getting or the quality of the people that they've been working with. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The people genuinely value the work that the experiment stations, the Extension Service, and Forestry Research Lab have provided, and they're frustrated because it's very important to their lives to have those services. And so the cuts are very frustrating, and in many ways threatening to them. We're not just talking about making a living, although that's certainly part of what people are concerned about. We're really talking about the sustainability of the way people live, and so it cuts very deeply for people. To give you an idea of some of the actions we've had to take, I know that there are some people in the Extension Service who've had their territory for their particular skill doubled or tripled, so they're dealing with maybe four or six different counties. To give you my perspective on what the statewides mean, not only in terms of the role that they play in our serving the needs of the people of Oregon, but the kind of message I use in talking about the statewides and talking to my colleagues in the university, I tell people in the university that we do research and creative work to address people's real needs, and it's ultimately critical that we find ways to take our research and creative work to applications so that we can, in fact, as our mission calls for us to do, expand economic development and provide for social progress in the state. And to me, the statewides are the poster child for how one makes research and creative work meaningful in people's lives. Because the way the Extension Service and Experiment Station Forestry Research Lab works is we go out and we meet people where they live, and we ask them what their issues are, and we work with them to find solutions. So again, I think this is the poster child for how research and creative work ought to be taken from university settings to the people that they serve. And I got to tell you that the poster's getting a little frayed around the edges. These programs, and this is the sense I've gotten from traveling around the state, are an integral part of the economic infrastructure of the rural communities that they serve. And that's that sense of frustration that I get from people out there. To give you a couple of statistics on the scope and importance of these programs, I'll just mention that the statewide public service programs conduct research and development that supports $24.1 billion in annual economic activity and 345,000 direct and indirect jobs in the state. These jobs produce 80% of the products in the traded sector economy. And again, as we all know, the traded sector is that segment of Oregon's economy that brings out-of-state resources to Oregon. Everybody has their notions and maybe familiarity with statewide programs. There are some wonderful examples out there that are really unique to Oregon. I'll mention just a few. The Seafood Lab in Astoria, developing new products, helping to revive the fishing industry in the state, the Food Innovation Lab in Portland that's helping small businesses develop ways to package and market their food products. And it's worth pointing out that the Food Innovation Lab is in fact the only urban experiment station in America. Something else that might surprise you, it certainly surprised me, was I think we're all aware of 4-H and the wonderful work that they do. I doubt that many Oregonians would know that, in fact, over the last 10 years, participation in the 4-H program has gone from 41,000 participants 10 years ago to 100,000 participants just this last year, and that there are 6,000 volunteers working with the 4-H program. And most of those participants come from towns with populations of 50,000 or more. A wonderful example of the kind of work that 4-H is doing now that I think most people would never imagine is the Tech Wizards program at Hillsboro High School. It's a program, a collaboration between 4-H, the high school, and Intel, in which the teachers identify at-risk Hispanic students. These are kids that are bright, but they may have behavioral problems or they're just hard to motivate to work in school. They take those students, put them in an after-school program where they teach them technologies, computers, global satellites, et cetera, et cetera. I visited the group last year. The graduation rate from high school for Hispanic students in the Portland metropolitan area is about 46%. The graduation rate in the 6 years that that program has been in place for the students who are selected because they're at risk from the Tech Wizards program, the high school graduation rate is 95%. And 90% of those graduates go on to get some form of post-secondary education. We've already had students who started out in Tech Wizards 6 years ago who have graduated from Oregon State University. So it's just a wonderful story, and I think it's an example of ways in which the statewides are serving the changing needs of the state of Oregon that most people wouldn't imagine possible. Let me stop there. As I said, there are others that I think it's important for you to hear from. Obviously, I'll be happy to answer questions later or now if you wish, but if there are questions, if not, I'd like to turn things over to Dean Thane Dudson from Agricultural Sciences, and he's the director of the experiment stations.
That would be fine, President Ray. I would, for the audience, Senator Nelson and Senator Walker would both actually want to be here. They're both testifying in other committees. Mm-hmm. We anticipate that they will be back sometime in the next 15 to 20, maybe 15 minutes to a half an hour. The co-chair had requested, and I planned for this, that the statewides would have an opportunity to present separately from, not separately, but as part of the OUS presentation, both in Phase 1 and Phase 2. Mm-hmm. So that will occur. So if you'll introduce the, as you said, the next person coming up to speak, we will get started.
Right. I'll introduce Dean Thane Dudson, Dean of Agricultural Sciences and Director of the Experiment Station.
Thank you, President Ray, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Thane Dudson, Director of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Station and Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences. To begin our presentations, we have some folks who work with our programs, who benefit from those programs, and do the kind of things that President Ray mentioned relative to our implementing those programs on the ground. The first two will be talking about the experiment station programs, and then we will have Hal Salwasser, the Dean of Forestry, introduce two folks that will be speaking about the Forest Research Lab, and Dr. Kung, Director and Dean of the OSU Extension Service, will be introducing two people to talk about the Extension Service. I would like to introduce to you Fred Ziari, IRZ Consulting from Hermiston, and Lee Powell, President of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. He's also with Garland Nursery in Corvallis.
Good morning. Good morning to you, Representative Jensen.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself and for the record.
My name is Fred Ziari. I'm president of IRZ Consulting and Easy Wireless. I have been living in Hermiston about last 24 years. We provide consulting and engineering and consulting services to agricultural community. I'm here to in support of the wonderful work that the experiment station and research doing. I used to be the chairman of the advisory committee for about a decade, so I can see firsthand the impact of the Oregon State University research and extension in the economy of our area. This is a little bit of a background, the way what I see the role of the future role of research is going to be, is that, for example, if in eastern Oregon, through the work, the irrigated agriculture and agriculture in general, we generate some $1.65 billion worth of agribusiness activity in an annual basis, and 55% of all jobs in eastern Oregon, northeastern Oregon, in Umatilla and Mora County directly related to agriculture and agribusinesses. So it's a huge part of it. And the OSU Research and Extension, the work that they do for our community, we really cannot say we could have done it without them. They have been partnered with us every step of the way. They do the type of research based on the input that we get, they get from the stakeholder rather than doing it on their own, and we really appreciate that. So we watch what they're doing, listen to us, and as a result we get a fantastic amount of value from it. And the value, as again, to our community in Eastern Oregon is just tremendous, in hundreds of millions of dollars worth of impact to our communities. The other part that I want to address is that really, if you look at it, we live in a global market and global economy. And as such, we need to start focusing on a different way that we used to. And that is that we need to start using technologies in a lot higher level than we ever have been. The fact of the matter is that we are adding somewhere between 80 to 100 million people to the world's population every single year. So you're looking at a billion people every decade or more. And if you look at it, at the same time, we are taking some million acre of most productive farmland in the United States out of production. At the same time, we have a huge hunger problem around the globe. 25,000 people a day die of starvation. Oregon, number one or number two, whatever ranking it is, very high ranking, unfortunately, in hunger issue. And when I look at it, I say, okay, who is going to solve these problems that we are going to be facing? The shortage of food, the shortage of land and resources. I don't think I'd be too far off by saying Oregon, Washington, maybe California and few other Western states, and that through the research and the development that we are doing, that is going to be next quarter of a century to 50 years how they're going to provide the food and fiber. And the work that we are doing, especially at Oregon State University, is going to be vital for generations to come. I'm not so worried about what's going to happen next year or so, but I'm really concerned about who is going to feed the world and the hunger issue we are seeing around the globe in the decades to come. And the work to start is right now. It may be a surprise to some of you that the largest broadband wireless Wi-Fi system in the globe is in Eastern Oregon. You could go for here you can go to a Starbucks or someplace and get on the wireless. In Eastern Oregon, you can go to nine cities, drive from city to city to cities, and you will never lose connectivity. The reason I'm mentioning that is that what is going to drive our future of agriculture is technologies. And I'm a member of the ETEC, which is Engineering Technology Industry Council, and the goal that they are doing is the same thing that our research and development at OSU is going to face, meaning we cannot compete muscle to muscle globally. We got to use our brain power and our technology in agriculture. Already we are using robotics in agriculture, where the tractors and the combine are driving without the input from a driver. They drive by themselves using the global positioning system, driving millimeter accuracy. We are using satellite technology. We are using lots of computer technology in order to do the farming. And as such, the future of OSU and research is going to be in the use of technology in increasing productivity in agriculture. And I'm here to support their activity, and I ask you to support it too. Thank you.
Representative Jensen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out to the committee that Mr. Zaire is probably a little modest in his presentation here. Fred is not just a consultant and engineer in Eastern Oregon. He's a national consultant, and for that matter, an international consultant. I believe on a couple of occasions he's gone to India for projects and development there. And when he talks about the broadband in Eastern Oregon, I think it's, is it June of 2004? Time Newsweek magazine. Mr. Zaire is recognized, and Hermiston is recognized as one of the top cities in the United States, joining like Austin, Texas, I think, if I'm as far as the advance of the technology of broadband in their community. So I just make these comments for the committee to recognize that, and for me to recognize Mr. Zaire, who is an extremely important part of the area. And I think, Mr. Chair, you'll remember several sessions ago when you, I believe, went with me to yes. Eastern Oregon, and much of what you saw at that time was a compliment and consequence of IRZ construction or consulting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, more of a comment, Mr. Zaire, than a question, but within the Extension Service and the Forestry Labs and so forth, we're seeing our staff age. And as they age, they retire. And we're losing, in my opinion, that institutional memory, that ability to know what management's practices have worked in the past and which ones haven't and who to contact and so forth within the community. And because of this reduced funding, and it's been pretty pretty severe over the last decade, we're having fewer and fewer people replace these senior staff members, so that we have lost that ability. Just like in Klamath Falls, last year, Dr. Ken Rybost retired from the experiment station. This year, Dr. Rodney Todd will retire from agronomy. Next year, Dr. Ron Hathaway, who was on the floor with me yesterday, will retire from extension. And there isn't a farm team out there to replace them. And I'm seeing the demise of this extension service and this Oregon extension. And it's, as you eloquently put it, it is essential to our rural communities.
I would go a little bit a step further. Again, you know, working throughout the United States and work globally, really, we underestimate. I mean, I'm not looking at these directors and these treasurers. You know, they're a treasure for the world, because this research that we are doing here, it not only impacts our economy, but if you look at it, and as I said, I'm genuinely concerned about the hunger issue and the problem that we are going to face, because it's accelerating so rapidly because of our population growth, that these research and the effort that we are making here is an improvement for mankind rather than just Klamath Basin, and that's the way I view it. And it is sad, because as I said, I used to be work with the experiment station, was it advisory or in the advisory committee, and I chaired it. And people that have replaced or retired, we never have been able to replace. So we see the impact, and they are. But we need, as a state, we need to recognize that and see whatever we can do to improve the research and the, at least on the funding end of it. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much for your
presentation. Thank you.
Chair Devlin and members of the Subcommittee on Education. My name is Lee Powell. I am current president of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, which is a 1,500-member organization of nursery and greenhouse products. Excuse me. I'm also co-owner of Garland Nursery, which is a retail garden center between Corvallis and Albany. We've been in business for 67 years. I'm here today to urge your support of the Oregon State University's agricultural research and extension programs, and in particular, I'd like to highlight the importance of OSU's extension service and experiment station. These two programs have been hit hard by budgetary cuts since 2001, and it's critically important the Oregon legislature return funding to these statewide public outreach units to the funding levels last seen in 1999. Unfortunately, SB 5513 fails to meet the modest goal of returning these programs to the funding levels of two budgets ago. To give you a little information about the Oregon nursery industry, in 2003, the Oregon nursery industry produced about $750, $770 million worth of product. Of that, $580 million worth of product went out of state, was exported back east into the Midwest. It's an industry that provides work for about 10,000 full-time workers and 11,600 part-time workers. I would venture to say that in Oregon agriculture, the nursery industry would be considered more of an upstart commodity in the industry. It has increased sales by 2.5 times since 1990. And what's interesting about the nursery industry is it's like other ag products. It is not made up of multinational organizations. It is made up of small businesses, predominantly family-owned businesses. These businesses don't have big research and development budgets. They rely on Oregon State researchers and experiment stations to help them with research and development, to help them with ideas on making their business successful, to help them fight the battles with pests and diseases. And in fact, I would like to highlight a few of the issues that OSU Research has helped the industry out on in the past couple of years. There are several names of pests and diseases that aren't real exciting and are a little bit hard to pronounce. Phytophthora syringae, honey locust, pod gall midge, and ligus. These aren't real sexy topics, I guess, but the fact of the matter is they have had $829,000 worth of direct economic benefits to the nursery industry in 2003 or 2004 alone, and those effects will continue each year to help the industry. That only represents, those are just three issues. That only represents a small slice of the economic impact and the help that OSU research and extension programs have given Oregon's agricultural economy. There are a number of other issues that OSU research has helped with as well. I'm going to stop and curse the pollen that my industry produces right now, as I'm having a little bit of trouble with allergies. So hopefully none of you blame any of your issues on me. But my business specifically attends OSU field days at their research stations every year. And we in particular, and I'm just talking about my own business, not the industry right now, but there are many people that go to these. It helps immensely to go to these and learn about the pests and diseases that are going to affect the plants that I grow and sell to my customers. And it has a huge impact on my business personally and a huge impact on the industry in general. In fact, last year, there was a disease problem called Phytophthora ramorum, and it's commonly known as sudden oak death. I imagine most of you have heard about this. It is a disease that had the potential of shutting down all exports of plant material from Oregon nurseries to other states. And I want to talk about this because other states have become large competition for us as well. And we've been dealing with issues like fuel prices, transportation. Some of the other states have become more competitive in their growing, and shortage of trucks. We have a lot of issues that face our industry, but that make it less competitive or tougher to sell our products out of state. And when something like a Phytophthora morum or a sudden oak death comes along, it can devastate our industry. It all of a sudden tips the scale in the favor of some of these other states that are growing these products. With the help of Oregon State Research and the help of the state and the help of, and the industry all working together, we were able to address some of the issues with it. We're trying to figure out the life cycle of P. remorum and get it under control so that we don't have any issues with states back east not wanting to buy our product. It's the federal, let's see, I guess what I'd say in summary is that the continued erosion of OSU's research and extension programs due to budgetary cutbacks will do serious harm to OSU's ability to help industry respond to the many changing threats that cloud our future. Phytophthora morum, aka sudden oak death, will not be the last issue that we deal with. There are more on the horizon, and we really need the Oregon State Research and Extension help to continue to be the economic agricultural commodity that we're starting to become. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. I'm Hal Salwasser, Dean of the College of Forestry and Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State University. And I'm pleased today to have with me Mr. Ray Jones, the Vice President of Resources for Roseburg Forest Products, who will provide some testimony for you.
Thank you, Dr. Salwasser, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, for giving me the opportunity to be here today. Many of us get the opportunity to talk about many things at many times, but when you have passion about something, it's easy to come forward and give testimony. Before I get to the heart of why I'm here, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our company. Roseburg Forest Products is a family-owned corporation. We have timberlands, substantial timberlands, I would say, and manufacturing facilities in Oregon, Northern California, and Montana. We own about 760,000 acres of our own timberlands. That's located in Northern California and Southwest Oregon. Our company has 9 manufacturing facilities. In fact, we may be best known for the products we produce because we produce a wide range of forest products, and we employ about 3,500 folks in our manufacturing and resource businesses. Now to the heart of why I'm here. Our company and the industry and all Oregonians heavily depend upon Oregon State University, not only for all the educational opportunities that many of us have enjoyed, but also, and the reason that I'm here today, for the research, science, and the extension services that benefit our company and the industry and anyone in the state that wants to take advantage of them. The ongoing work at the Forest Research Lab directly benefits our forest products sector. I'd like to talk about 2 sectors of the business today, the forest products sector and the forest management sector. The Forest Products Lab offers the latest science and research around wood chemistry, wood technology, manufacturing processes, value-added products, and international marketing of products. Oregon retains a very strong and very competitive forest products industry. We utilize the latest milling technology, and through continued investment, and our company invests heavily in milling technology, we can compete globally. We compete when we're the best, just like anyone in any other business, and the best means having the lowest costs, the highest product recoveries, and the Forest Research Lab is really a partner with us in assisting and developing and sharing the technology. We have to change with a changing industry, which means we have to continually stay on the leading edge of technology. Not only the survival of small businesses, but also large businesses in our sector depends upon the services and the extension services of the Forest Research Lab. As I mentioned, our company also owns and manages a large acreage of timberland in two states. Our forest management sector is also very dependent upon the Forest Research Lab. Everyone in this room knows, what you might call it, the citizens of the state, and in the Northwest, we debate forest policy every day, many times without much scientific basis. In order to find reasonable answers around sustainability, water quality, regulatory change, wildlife protection and management, we must make those decisions based upon best science. Many times when we enter the debate, the science is old or it doesn't exist. Much like milling technology, we must continually move ahead by making the investment in continued research and science. There's a project called the Hinkle Creek Project. It's located on our land, about 5,000 acres of our land, and we've set aside this land for 10 years, a minimum of 10 years, for a research cooperative project. The objective is to research water temperature, water flows, turbidity, buffer designs, fish populations, and the timber harvesting effects on fish. The Oregon Forest Research Lab is the lead, and they're the coordinator of this research project, which involves many, many agencies. It's not just the Oregon Forest Research Lab. But I think this is a really good example of the leadership that Oregon State has taken in the research and scientific community. It's also a demonstration of the real need for science and research to find vital answers around forest policy on private, state, and federal lands. Our company and private landowners benefit from the knowledge and research around genetics, reforestation, tree growth, long-term sustainability, and harvest. Our company contributes financially to a number of OSU research cooperatives. In addition, the industry and our company supports research through the Oregon Forest Products Harvest Tax. A piece of the harvest tax is paid directly to the research lab. The financial, social, and economic implications from sustainable resource management are critical for our state, critical for the Northwest. I'd like to summarize with a few comments and then close. Our state, the forest product sector, and the owners or managers of forest land depend heavily upon the multitude of services, science, and research that's provided by the Oregon Forest Research Lab. Mr. Chair, I believe in my heart of hearts that our state cannot afford a reduction in research and in science at a time when the pace of change is accelerating. Our industry has and will continue to go through tremendous change and transition. We know that. We also know that we can continue to manage the change and we can remain competitive in the world marketplace, but we have to stay with advances in technology to do it, and in science, and in better marketing. We need the help of the Oregon Forest Research Lab. They're our partners in technological advancement and in shaping forest policy through expansion of forest and wildlife research projects. To close, I would again ask for your continued support or to support the current budget levels for the Oregon Forest Research Lab. Our company believes that the entire state has a vested interest in a healthy forest products industry. We need to continue to produce renewable products. We also, at the same time, need to manage habitat for wildlife. We also, at the same time, need to provide for family wage jobs and continued tax revenues. We can't forget that our forest product sector is still number two in Oregon's economic engine. We think the state should continue to invest in our industry by supporting the current budget levels for the Forest Research Lab. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the committee for the opportunity to be here.
Senator Whitsitt, then Senator Nelson.
Senator Devlin, Mr. Ford, first I just wanted to compliment to you personally and Rosebrook Lumber for your heavy investment in that Hinkle Creek study. I think that's, as you know, too often our laws are made on best available science, which too often means the only available science, and that is often outdated, inaccurate, sometimes slanted, and rarely peer-reviewed. And this Hinkle Creek study is going to fix a lot of that. I understand from the quality assurance and so forth that's built into that process, it is you're going to have some very excellent science that will be peer-reviewed and will be the best available science, and I compliment you for your investment in that. And I would certainly hope that the state can help you on it.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several things, I guess. I'm sorry I missed your testimony, but we had some other things going on. But Representative Jensen and I are fortunate because Fred always tells us what's going on, and he's very practical. And I appreciate your testimony, too, Mr. Ford, just because I have that same sense. But I think we need, the underlying interest that we all have up here is how are we going to continue to fund our public services? I've always felt, one, we're not utilizing our natural resources, whether it's trees or water. I'd like to have you comment basically on the Clinton Forest Plan. I'd like also you to comment on the fact that at least my impression is that if you take federal lands versus private lands, the federal lands are basically a mess. When they have a fire, they really have a fire. When these fires are coming on private lands, they're not to that extent. I mean, our policies are making us a mediocre state, basically. That's what I'm trying to get to. I mean, Senator Gourley, we both have a way to solve the problem, and so we're trying to work together on this thing. But from your viewpoint as an expert in this area, I'd just like to comment on the underutilization of natural resources, the Clinton Forest Plan, and are the forest lands really as poorly managed as I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I have lots of opinions around our federal land management, and particularly the Northwest Forest Plan. And I'll try to keep it brief. The Northwest Forest Plan originally was a compromise. It was a compromise between the administration at that time, forest owners, forest operators, environmental communities, and other stakeholders. And so, in my view, it was an agreement back in 1994. But it's fair to say that it's a broken agreement. And the reason it's broken is litigations and lawsuits. The forest plan has never been really implemented because of those reasons, litigations and lawsuits. And basically, stakeholders have changed their position from 1994 over the last decade to now 2004. So it is broken. As an operator of federal timber sales, I could tell you many war stories, but I won't. But what I can tell you is, as the age of the tree increases, so does the controversy. So, is there a resolution around current management on federal land, which is very slow compared to the past, and nowhere near what the plan promised in the way of volume? I would say yes. Would the Northwest Forest Plan look the same? Probably no. But It's going to be a combination of policy resolution and legislative resolution, I believe, to restore management on federal lands. The Healthy Forest Restoration Act that was passed last year will help. It's a beginning, but it's not the whole solution. Too much?
No.
Okay.
And it's my understanding there'd be literally thousands of jobs created if we were able to get back and at least get to the Clinton Forest Plan. Do you have any? You guys do any studies on any of those things?
We've done a lot of study around that. Again, to keep the comments brief, maybe I could just make them in reference to the area that we operate most in, and that would be Southwest Oregon. I would share with you that our area in Southwest Oregon is about 400 million board feet short of satisfying the demand for all the milling technology that exists in that part of the state. And a logical question is, well, why are they operating? Well, the logs are imported. They're imported from Canada, Northern Washington, Northern California, and Eastern Oregon. That's how the gap's filled. Now, how that relates to the Northwest Forest Plan is the region that supports our timber supply is producing about 40% against the promise made in the Northwest Forest Plan. Actually, it's about 35%. And so if the government delivered on the promise, it would cover that supply shortage and, in effect, keep a healthy infrastructure going that can manufacture products out of those logs.
One of the things that I hear is that, particularly from my urban counterparts, are saying, well, yeah, we're subsidizing you guys out in eastern Oregon or southern or rural Oregon or something. And you know, my answer always is back as well. 30 years ago, we were probably subsidizing you because we were able to properly use our forests. And to me, it's just we're in a mess here because we're not utilizing these resources, whether it's trees or water out of the Columbia River. And as a result, our children are hurting. So the underlying interest here, I mean, we're not funding education. You guys are coming in asking us for money for your programs. I mean, we should be making these investments. But we're hamstrung. And so my thrust, at least this session, is to say, okay, how are we going to solve this problem? And, you know, I hope to get a chance to talk to you later on about this because, you know, I'm trying to figure out what we can do as a state because I realize there's federal issues involved in this that are very, very significant. But it seems to me as if we as a state, whether it's the Higher Education Department or AFL-CIO or the Teachers Union or the governor or the legislature, we all get by and say, if this is what we really need to solve the problem, then we make a greater step. And I don't see us doing that at this point. So that's my soapbox again. My committee members are probably going to beat up on this because I keep trying to hit on that subject. That's just a solution.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I'd welcome that opportunity at some future date to have a long dialogue about that.
Thank you. Well, Senator Nelson, as one legislator who values consistency from members, you get high marks. Senator Gourley, did you have a...
No, I'll pass. But when that opportunity is created, I would love to be a part of that conversation. And thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. For the record, my official legal name is Ling Jun Kung, but for your convenience, I answer to Kelvin Kung. I'm here to introduce the speakers so they'll make some conversation, a presentation to you on behalf of Extension Service. And currently, I am serving as an interim dean and director of Extension Service at Oregon State University. But first, I'd like to call Ms. Lupe Flores.
Lupe, please.
Lupe is currently a second-year student at Portland Community College, formerly a member of 4-H Tech Wizard Club, Dr. Ray mentioned earlier, and she will share with you some of her experiences.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Lupe Flores. I'm in my second year of college at Portland Community College. After graduating from high school, Hillsborough High School in Washington County, I have been in 4-H with Wizards for 6 years. I am here today to ask for continued strong funding for 4-H and the OSU Extension Service Program. Before I started 4-H with Wizards, I was very discouraged and thinking about dropping out of high school. A counselor told me that Latino students did not graduate or go to college. A month later, I was introduced to 4-H and everything changed. My Intel Latino networks and mentors and 4-H staff encouraged me to continue in school and told me and convinced me that I could go to college, and they believed in me. In 4-H, I learned that giving back to my community is a pleasure. I learned to fight for what I want and for my future, to make good choices, setting goals, and problem solving. I now have a different way of looking at life. I have received a congressional award for community service, helped launch a new national initiative called Cyber Seniors, Cyber Teens, where I help to teach seniors how to use the computer, and presented a workshop about my 4-H community service project at a national conference in New Orleans. When my little brother started high school, I told him to join 4-H Stitch with Wizards, that it will change his life. He was president of the club this last year. I was the first one in my family to graduate from high school and the first one to go to college. In college, I plan to get a bachelor's degree, and I am interested in a career in computers and technology. Without a strong support extension, and 4-H has had in the past, many of these educational opportunities would not have been possible for me or the thousands of others 4-Hers in the state of Oregon like me. Thank you for the funding you have provided to extension and 4-H programs, and thank you for allowing me to speak to you today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gore.
Ms. Flores, thank you so much for your testimony. I just want to say to you that you're going to be very successful, and you will achieve anything that you want to achieve. You're going to do that. And to the Chancellor, and I know you're paying close attention to what Ms. Flores has said in her testimony, she made the statement that she had a counselor, a high school counselor, I believe, who told her that she could not expect to go to college. That statement and the experience that she had is exactly why we need to be on this track toward cultural competency. And again, Chancellor, I say to you, that's why your efforts at leading our Oregon University system toward cultural competency are so critical. Ms. Flores' experience happens over and over and over and over and over again with too many students in our schools around the state. That's what we're trying to get at. But again, Ms. Flores, you're going to be successful, and I appreciate very much your thoughtful presentation. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Thank you very much, Ms.
Thank you. The next presentation will be coming up here to county commissioners. And for those of you, if you're not aware of the extension program, it is a partnership program between the federal government and state government and the county government. And I'm fortunate to have Judge Laura Pryor from Gillum County and Commissioner Steve McClure from Union County to share their thoughts with you.
Good Judge Pryor, I regret that the Democrats on this committee on the Senate side have to leave like within about 30 seconds.
30 seconds?
But the committee will continue, and we will be back for phase two some weeks hence, and we will have more public testimony at that time regarding the statewide programs. But the rest of the committee will stay here. It's just the Senate Democrats that have been called to a caucus. So Senator Gordley and I, who are the only two present from that, have to leave here in about 30 seconds. So you have as much time as you need, but Senator Gordley and I will have to leave. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry that we'll lose both of you.
Please
it's, been,
know
it's a pleasure
also,
to see you.
If I may add that we do, when we miss testimony, we do review the videotapes, audio tapes, and testimony. So,
thank you.
Please know that.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I do not know the other county commissioner, but Judge Pryor and I have known each other for years and years and years. So,
since I have red hair, I think he's safe.
Well, so I will turn over the gavel to my very able colleague, Senator Nelson.
Please thank
introduce
you.
Yourself and continue.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Laura Pryor, and I am the county judge in Gillam County, which is in eastern Oregon.
I'm Steve McClure, Union County Commissioner.
I want to take this opportunity, and I want to thank the Oregon State for asking us to be here. I want to talk about the other part of the mission of the land-grant university, and that is the extension and the research stations. And I want to take just a short moment or two to kind of frame the discussion and to talk to you about why I'm here today. My family, I have a wheat farm, and it's a second-generation wheat farm in rural eastern Oregon. And so when I'm talking to you, I'm talking to you from that perspective. I'm talking to you from the perspective of being involved in an industry, a very large industry, the wheat industry, which is very important to Portland. It's very important to the Port of Portland. It's very important to the balance of trade of this nation, because it's one of the things that people are still buying from us and still need from us, although that's changed. I want to take this opportunity to talk to you about a very specific project that I think will make it real to you about how this all works together. And I want to take you from the ground, literally, the wheat fields in our county, to Singapore or Thailand or Korea or whoever's buying in the market. Oregon's been selling wheat into the international trade arena since the very beginning. And we've been dependent upon being able to produce that. We fed the world after the Second World War. The university, the land-grant university and their research was at the heart of that. Almost anybody that knows anything about wheat knows the name Warren Cronstadt and the research that he did on the Green Revolution that enabled the rest of the world to begin to feed themselves. So the research, the core of the research at the land-grant university is at the heart of all of what happens in the industry and how it begins to grow out from there and ends up in seeds in the ground on our farm. In 1981, Gillam County, which only has 2,000 people total, had 357 wheat farmers that were actually operating on the ground. We have 6,000 landowners, so there's a lot of people that own land there that don't live in Gillam County. But we had 357 wheat growers actually operating. Today I have 56. Now, what happened? Well, there's a number of things that happened, but one of the biggest things that happened to us was a decision by the Australian government, and I'm giving you a snapshot of all this, in the early 80s when they decided that the Pacific Rim was their market. Now, over 80% of the wheat produced in the Pacific Northwest goes into export into the Pacific Rim. So when the Australian government made a policy decision at the highest level that they were going to take over that market, that was their market, that was significant. what happened to us was we just kind of stayed on the same path. The researchers were trying to get us a better wheat that would grow more bushels because we get paid by the bushel. And nobody was paying much attention to what the quality of it was or what the millers and bakers in the Pacific Rim needed. We were still on the path after the Second World War of just trying to feed people. At that point, nobody was asking for quality. They wanted quantity. They wanted to eat. So we were producing fence posts to fence posts to give them food. Well, Australia decided that they would send people in the Pacific Rim to the millers and bakers and try to figure out, for the end products, for the products that you make to feed your people, whether it's a udon noodle, a flat bread, or a steam cake, what do you need out of our wheat? We lost our market. Pacific Northwest lost the market. A huge market share just vanished for us. So now how does that relate to this small county? Well, we produce between 3 to 7 million bushels just in our county alone a year, and we certainly don't produce what Umatilla County does, which is a much better wheat growing area than ours. We're dryland wheat, very little irrigation in the county. So when we realized what was happening to us, and the Farm Bill of 1984 came along right after that and took half the land out of production and put it into the Conservation Reserve Program, we got a double hit. In the international market, we started getting the hit, and then we got a hit here at home with the change in the farm program. So what we decided was we were going to have to try to do something about it. We were either going to try to tackle this problem, or we were just going to go away. So what we did was we began a project that at the foundation of it is the Oregon Extension Program. And I want to show you this. What you see here is Gillen County. And all those different colors don't signify anything except a different field, so that you can tell how many fields there are. Now, at the top, that's the Columbia River Highway, and that's the Columbia River, because my county's right on the Columbia River and goes south. It goes south to over 3,000 feet. And we're not as blessed as some of the other Eastern Oregon counties to be reasonably level. We have huge, deep canyons, the John Day River Canyon. We have big canyons, 1,000, 2,000 feet canyons in there. So we farm on the top. And we have hillside combines which level. They don't run straight. They have to level the reel so they can cut the wheat. So there's a big challenge. Very little rainfall. 9 inches a year. And very shallow soil. Huge, huge obstacles to overcome. We would kill to have the land that is right out here. Beautiful farmland down here. And what we decided was that we were going to have to build a database. Every farmer knows what's happening on his fields. My husband's farm field 327A, it's 300 acres in that field, and he knows what happens in that field. What we didn't know was what happens across the county. What's going on? So the first thing we did was we put up weather stations across the county to try to see what the microclimates are. And then the extension program began to build us a database based on every one of those fields. And the data from the weather stations goes into that database. And then we began to try to figure out, on these fields, when you're planting in any one year, you're subject to rainfall and how much sun you get and all those things. And, okay, how much nitrogen are you going to put in the ground? What kind of fertilizers are you going to put in the ground? All the inputs goes into the database per field. This is an enormous task. The three wheat commissions in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho are talking about identity preservation and value added. But talking and talking and talking isn't going to get it done. What we're doing is trying to figure out how do you do that? And what do you need to do? Because we need to know what the effects are for every field on the different kinds of soft white wheat that you can grow. This is a daunting task, really. What I have been watching our farmers do is have to sit down and almost take their head off and screw it around and put it back down again, because for generations they have been putting seed in the ground, harvesting the seed, selling it, and putting seed in the ground, harvesting it, selling it, putting a seed, not having to really think about the markets and the end use. For instance, we know more about what kinds of wheats and what percent proteins of those wheats and the ash content and so forth for the udon noodle than we do the chocolate chip cookie. And this is the best pastry flour in the world that's grown in Oregon. So we need to find those things out. So in a partnership with Extension, who's helping us ask the questions, develop the database, and build this whole foundation of information. Then we work with the test plots to try new things. We work with the experiment station and the researchers at the university. It is all of a piece so that we can try to figure out how are we going to get that market back. How, for the millers and bakers in Singapore who have different needs than ones in Korea, how are we going to do that? And, oh, by the way, I'd love to sell some of this to Nabisco. So what do they need? So it is an incredible change in the thinking. It's an incredible change in the makeup of the industry itself. At what people used to say was the lowest level. But that's the formative level. That's the integral level that you've got to have. So the changes in thinking and energy that's going on could not be done without the help of the Extension program. Now, when they started taking the first hits, you heard earlier that the remaining extension agents had to take over larger areas. That's very true. To keep one in my county of 2,000 people and have them continue this project with us, we had to step forward and try to find the money ourselves to help pay for the position and pay for the secretary and pay for the Xerox machine and just to keep the connection, because the extension agent is on the ground link back to the researcher, back to the investment that this state has made for, 100 years in the land-grant university. That extension agent is that link for us. And now that extension agent is getting spread thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. Oh, and to keep them, we've had to try to participate. Now, to give you an idea of the magnitude of this project, this, we believe, is a roadmap for the industry. This is going to be a roadmap that we can say to any other grower group, this is how we did it. You may want to do it different, but this is how we did it. And this is what the extension did. And if you want to do it, here's how to follow down this path. And I believe that is going to happen, because it must happen. So what I think I want to encourage all of you is to think about the role and the mission of the land-grant university and the research and the experiment stations and the test plots that finally get out to us. And how the information from all of that, what the results of those things are, goes back to the researchers and to the university and is able to help the industry. The Oregon wheat grower taxes himself 5 cents a bushel to help research themselves. Now, county government is stepping in to try to be of assistance to keep it going. So by not having it, It's not a simple thing, because everything's interconnected. Everything is interconnected. in our society, the big systems link. So I'm going to ask you, you have a terrible task before you, but I'm going to ask you to think about what Oregon has invested in and what you have created and how significant it is. And I want to leave you with one last thought. I couldn't send somebody to Singapore. We didn't have the money. So we went out and we found an Oregon company, a growing Oregon company, that does wheat products development. If you go to Costco and you buy their big packages of muffins, that's an Oregon company that's making those mixes and developing those formulas. They are going to be using Oregon soft white wheat. So it led, the research, this database led us to go find a partner that is now building a mix facility in Oregon. They did not go to Washington. They stayed here to build. And they're being able to develop their customer base because we are going to be able to deliver to them for their formulas what they need. And if we can do that for them, we will be able to do it for the millers and bakers in Taiwan and Singapore. We will be able to compete on that level. So this is not a tiny little thing. This is a major component of an industry in Oregon that can grow. And I want to encourage you that the Land Grant University's mission is alive and well, created in 1862, but it is as vital today as it was when we created it. Thank you.
What's the name of the company?
Integrated Bakery Resources.
Integrated Bakery Resources.
Mm-hmm.
Questions? Yeah, Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Pryor, when I visited your facility and community, you were doing mostly wheat research, but you were also doing some research on barley. Is
yes.
that still going on?
It is. Barley, triticale, wheat, and oats. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for remembering.
That was a good trip. I think I was on that trip.
Mm-hmm. You were?
Excellent. Any further questions?
Yeah. Senator Nelson, just a comment. I think your story is really told all over the state of Oregon in Climas. It is Oregon State Selenium Research that allows us to grow cattle on ground that you couldn't grow without
yeah.
it. The potato industry is dependent upon the experiment stations down there and all the things that they've done in the past years. I've done great research on hybrid poplar growth for wood products and so forth. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, and you're right, that is the connection. And as I said earlier, and I don't want to beat it to death, but we're losing that connection. It's growing old and retiring, and we have no farm team coming up.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to respond to that. You're absolutely correct. And I would like to say something to you as a juvenile judge. Because I am a juvenile judge, and indirectly it speaks to that, and that's about 4-H. You know, I see a lot of kids, unfortunately, in juvenile court, and over 18 years I've seen a few. Our kids are bored to death. Our kids are bored out of their minds. And you don't have Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and Campfire Girls and things that you had at one time. But extension is something that is still there, and it even gives the kids even more values. It makes their lives richer. And to be able to keep kids in 4-H and then lead them to FFA, which would lead them perhaps to wanting to have a life in this industry, a life in agriculture, a life as an extension agent. If there's no connection, if they never know about it, if they don't understand it, you're right. Why would they get there? They won't get there. Just like this young lady. If somebody hadn't helped her understand how she could change her life with a computer and technology, she wouldn't know. So without 4-H and without leading to FFA, we are going to lose a tremendous asset for our children that is a great and valuable tool. The thing that Extension does best is teach people on the ground in their community where they live. and they know how to do it, and they know how to do it better than anybody. So you really have a tool at your beck and call that can do a number of things other than what it's doing now. It can do great things for businesses, marketing plans, business plans, feasibility studies, you name it. They know how to do it. So we need to not think about shrinking it. We need to think about how can we use this tool creatively to do all the jobs that aren't getting done now. What could they do?
Further questions? Thank you, Judge Pryor.
Thank you.
Good testimony. Too.
Thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I could certainly take the time to explain the importance of extension in Union County, and there's a lot of examples of that. I think Judge Pryor talks about 4-H. 4-H is extremely important in our community. We have a 4-H camp that's been there since the early 60s. The whole thing of extension is real in our community, and it always has been. But I would like to talk to it a little broader, if I could. As it was mentioned earlier, extension is a partnership between the federal government, the states, and the counties. And if you look at what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years since I've been a commissioner, and you look at the impacts of ballot measure 5 and ballot measure 47 and ballot measure 50, you would think the partner that would probably be weak or getting out of this would be the local governments. I mean, it's been a real struggle for local governments in the last 15 years to meet their obligation under this partnership. Now, it's been done a couple of ways throughout the state. One way that's been very effective is extension service districts. A lot of counties have formed those districts. They've gone to the voters of the people and said, here's a program. Do you think it's important? And it's amazing. In my county, they passed an extension service district. That's a statement from the people that live in my county that extension is extremely important. Counties that don't have extension service districts, because of some of the ballot measures that we've had to deal with, have had to make some tough decisions in the last 15 years, and they continue to support the extension program. So from my perspective, if you look at it from the local partners, the very fact that the local partners have been able to put the money or willing to put the money on the table to continue to support extension, to me, is a great statement about how important extension is in the rural parts of this state. The other thing I'd like to talk about just briefly is Laura talked about a big project, and I would like to talk about extension just a little bit differently. Having been a commissioner for nearly 15 years, I'd like to talk about how I interact with extension, how it becomes a part of what I do every day. In the last 3 weeks, I've had an opportunity to deal with our extension agents on a couple of issues that come up just routinely as we deal with our communities. One was an issue concerning roadside vegetation as it relates to sugar beets and potatoes. We call the extension agent, set up a meeting with the growers, we sit down and talk about the issues that we have. I called last Friday on drought declarations. So when we talk about extension, we talk about the special things they do, but I also think I need to stress to you that extension is a part of the fabric of the communities out there. We deal with it on a day-to-day basis. I just think you need to keep those things in mind as you make some decisions. As the judge said, we certainly appreciate that you're having to make some tough decisions. We in local government have had to make those over the last 10 or 15 years. We know that they're not easy, but we would caution that you look at the value of these programs and make the decisions in the light of the needs of the community and the support that's out there for these programs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Just some comment here talking about partnerships. I mean, the counties have partnerships, have they even in past extension? I mean, you do health care services, things like that. I think that's something that we ought to really always be putting more trust on you folks. And just a question along those lines, in the most perfect world, how would you see the state interacting with the counties to help you fulfill a lot of your obligations that you're doing at the community level? Is that a pretty broad statement, but it's... It's a softball pitch here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I appreciate that, Senator.
Yeah.
I think from the local government's perspective is we would like to be viewed as true partners in these relationships, and that when decisions are made that we're brought to the table and we're able to enter into the discussions that garner the decisions that we have to deal with. I think that's a big issue from our perspective. We do feel like we are partners. We work together with the state, the federal government, to deliver these programs. And we feel, I think, that we need to be at the table when the decisions are being made about how these programs are going to be done, how they're going to be funded, and initially in those processes.
Mr. Chairman, I would second everything that Commissioner McClure said, and I think I would add one other thing, and that is this. When you don't have any money, you got to get creative. We got to do things different. All of us do. The decisions that you make will affect us, and we will have to respond to how that occurs. So one thing that I would just reinforce that Commissioner McClure said is, I think we, the local governments, can be a partner with you in trying to figure out how to do things differently. Now, all of us, whether it's you or whether it's us, depending upon in the public arena out there whose bull's getting gored or thinks that's getting gored, are going to be yammering at all of us. But the truth is, I think that there's a tremendous opportunity when you don't have any money to try to look at things and say which things are working and which things can do something else as well. When we had a lot of money, we created different things to do specific things. I know in my county, there's no one employed in my courthouse that has one job. They have to do five or six different things. And we have to try to find the way to do things differently. Now, I am going to just make a suggestion to you, with all due respect. Things are done differently across this state. And if we could do them the way they work, it might save some money. Instead of doing them the way we're told to do them, because this is easier for 36 counties, one agency to deal with 36 counties in this box. I'm glad, but I don't have people living under a bridge in my county. There's coyotes and rattlesnakes under the bridge. Okay, but I know that in the metropolitan part of the state, that's a real issue for them. So whatever kinds of monies are being directed our way to solve that problem, I'm either going to have to try to bend that program around to fit our need, or basically, I don't need it. I mean, I know that's something that no elected person should ever say to you, I don't need the money, but the truth is, if we could make it work, no matter what you're looking at, if we could make it work the way it does work actually across the state, it would work better and you probably would save some money. Now, that's another daunting task, but that's my response to you.
Last time we're giving you a softball question. No, it isn't really. I mean, we do need to talk about those things because it's very crucial. Further questions from the committee?
Senator Nelson, just one thing, and I think that, you know, I've been rural all my life, and I think one of the things that draws us to the rural community is the privacy and the quietness of the countryside and of the population, and that's perhaps one of our own worst enemies, in that when we have very good success stories, we keep them to ourselves, and I think that it's imperative now that we change that policy, and I've been one of the worst of keeping what's mine. But I mean, we've got to bring other people into what we're doing, other people in it. We're not destroying the environment. We're actually environmentalists. That there's a lot of people out of there that would really like to share what we do and what we know. And I think it's imperative that we start doing that while we're still surviving.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Do we have more witnesses?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't believe there are any more witnesses for today. Just to let you know, next week on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, you'll be wrapping up the Phase 1 hearings for OUS, and they will be following what is in the notebooks that they've given you on pages 3, 4, and 5, respectively.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the committee. I appreciate everybody coming to testify. And you know, in this process, people move in and out. But as Senator Gourley does say, we do keep up on these things and get all the information. I think one of the things I think the senator and the representatives have all brought out is that, you know, there's urban interests and there's rural interests. And so how do we mix them together and how do we make this a better state? So I appreciate your coming down and giving us your viewpoint of the world, because it's very important. Thank you. With that, any questions for the committee? We will adjourn the committee. Thank you.